This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The capacity of the plant will be, we start by producing 50 million of vaccines at the beginning, but it will be increased, the capacity will be increased to reach huge number of vaccines as by demand.
That's Rwanda's health minister, Daniel Ngamji, on plans for German biotechnology giant BioNTech to build a vaccine plant in Kigali to ease the continent's scarcity of vaccines for COVID-19 and other viruses. Details coming up. Also, in South Africa, the bloody build-up to next Monday's local government polls continues. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. UN Secretary Antonio Guterres has strongly condemned the military takeover in Sudan, calling it part of a rash of coups by military leaders who feel that they have total impunity due to lack of strong international response. Speaking before a closed-door Security Council meeting to discuss Sudan on Tuesday, he cited strong geopolitical divides and difficulties in getting the Council to agree on actions, along with the impact of COVID-19 and financial weakness in many countries. He joined a chorus of other world leaders in urging the coup organizers to reverse course and allow Sudan to return to the path towards democracy that it has been navigating since the ouster of longtime dictator Omar al-Bashir in 2019. Before the Security Council meeting, British Ambassador Barbara Woodward told reporters, 2 years ago, the people of Sudan put their lives on the line for democracy, and they should not have to do so again. Sudan's coup leader, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, has said the military seized power Monday to prevent civil war. He said he had imposed a state of emergency, dissolved civilian rule, and arrested top officials because political groups have been inciting civilians against the security forces. Several protesters have been killed and dozens of others injured by security forces. In the center of Khartoum, near the foreign ministry and the government offices, the streets are quiet today, but protests against the military takeover of the government are expected this evening. For the latest in Sudan, VOA's Kate Pondawson spoke with journalist Mohammed Ali Fazari.
In the city of Khartoum, you cannot see the life being normal because of the state of emergency, and you see here people still not coming to their work. My office is very close to foreign ministry, and there are so many shops and many offices closed down. Still people very cautious to go for work, but still people calling for a big demonstration, which you call the 1 million march demonstration on October 30. And also there are some calls for civil disobedience. These are the two ways that the Sudanese use for resisting this coup. 12 ambassadors from different countries all over the world, they stand beside the Sudanese people demand, which is a demand of the civilian government and to supporting democracy. These are from China, from Belgium, UAE, Kuwait, and other countries that they said they will support the will of the transition, the transitional government, and they show full solidarity with Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and his government. Also, some political parties here issued a statement rejecting what they describe as the coup, and they said General Burhan betrayed the revolution, and they said they will not accept such a procedure and let it return back to the civil government.
Now, we understand that Prime Minister Hamdok has been allowed to return to his home, although I understand he is under guard. Has that improved or changed the public sentiment?
Yes, Abdul Hamdok, President Prime Minister, released after a press conference held by General Burhan, the army leader, and said that he was safe and secure and he was in his home. So he said he will return back home and when the security situation is improved. And this is a single step. I don't think it is going to improve the situation most of the time because at the time that Hamdok released, another politician leader was also detained, Mr. Sadiq al-Sadiq al-Mahdi, the son of the Sudanese historic leader Sadiq al-Mahdi, was detained last night from his home and put into custody. Others with other ministers and members of the Sovereignty Council were there also. But it's only one way that they released Mr. Hamdok. And I think this is due to regional and international pressure for the General Burhan to release all the detainees and also to return back to the civilian government and not to go ahead for...
That was journalist Muhammad Ali Fazari speaking with Kate Bond-Dawson from his office near Sudan's foreign ministry in Khartoum. Fazari also said pro-democracy activists are organizing what they call a million-person march on Saturday. In South Africa, the bloody build-up to next Monday's local government polls continues, particularly in KwaZulu-Natal province. Police sources say most of the killings appear to be as a result of political rivalry within the ruling African National Congress, or ANC. But they added candidates for town and city council seats from other parties seen as a threat to the ANC's dominance in certain areas are being killed now too. Darren Taylor reports.
Being a city or town councillor in South Africa is a big deal. It gives local politicians, who are otherwise minor political players, access to multi-million rand tenders. They decide which companies get lucrative contracts to deliver basic services. Successful bidders often pay huge kickbacks to councillors who favour them. Yesterday, community members in Nongoma, KwaZulu-Natal, found the body of Dumisani Qwabe, who was a candidate for the National Freedom Party, the NFP. Party Secretary General Kanan Mdletshe says Qwabe was assassinated because he stood a good chance of being elected as a councillor on Monday.
Comrade Dumisani Qwabe was found in a burning car in Nongoma. From the information we received from the police and our comrades at the scene right now, his car had bullet holes all over it and there were some blood stains in the car as well as on the ground at the scene, which to us then clearly demonstrates that our comrade was shot and killed before he was put into the car, which was then set alight.
Mary De Haas, a human rights activist who's been documenting violence in KwaZulu-Natal since the 1980s, says the province has always been ripe for political strife.
Too many guns, too many hitmen. But in terms of the political violence, the main problem is the culprits aren't found. If I look at the couple of dozen killings before the 2016 elections, I only know one conviction for those killings, and that conviction was done by a member of one of the provincial teams. I have a problem with the
ANC government has tasked a national police team with solving political killings in KwaZulu-Natal. De Haas says this squad reports to National Police Minister Bheki Cele, who's also one of the ruling party's most senior officials in the province. In that context, says the Violence Monitor, no wonder opposition parties are accusing the ANC of protecting its alleged hitmen.
This is not about personalities. It's about the role of a police minister who's a senior politician overseeing the work of a task team, which is completely unacceptable. You don't allow a politician, regardless of who that politician is, to actually himself or herself have any access to what the task team is doing. I mean, I have it on good authority that the head of the task team is not even a detective and that he reports to the minister, which is highly irregular. He should be reporting to the commissioner. And I have not seen this task team in 3 years producing any credible results.
Cele dismisses suggestions he's involved in covering up ANC atrocities. That may be so, says de Haas, but the way the government's probing the political strife is very suspicious. De Haas says her sources in law enforcement have told her of a report about rogue intelligence agents affiliated to the ANC running political hit squads in KwaZulu-Natal.
Now, that report was allegedly handed from the head of intelligence, then General Jacobs, to the political task team. And it is alleged that the minister did not do anything about it.
Cele says crime intelligence reports are confidential, but his officers are investigating all credible leads about political killings. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The UN Security Council and the United States have imposed sanctions on a Libyan official over the alleged abuse and torture of migrants in a detention center. The Security Council and the U.S. said in separate statements late yesterday that Osama al-Kuni is the de facto head of a detention center in the North African nation's west. Migrants there are said to have been subjected to torture, sexual and gender-based violence, and human trafficking. Libya emerged as a major conduit for African migrants hoping to reach Europe after a NATO-backed uprising toppled and killed the country's longtime dictator, Muammar Gaddafi, in 2011. The country subsequently slid into chaos. The Rwandan government signed an agreement yesterday with German biotechnology giant BioNTech to build a vaccine plant in Rwanda to ease the scarcity of COVID-19 and other vaccines on the continent. Eugenie Wimana has more details from Kigali.
The memorandum of understanding says the plant will be worth more than $116 million and will be set up in the special economic zone in Kigali's Gasabo district. Health Minister Daniel Ngamije told reporters that once this starts operating, it will be able to fulfill Africa's demand.
The capacity of the plant will be, we start by producing 50 million of vaccines at the beginning, but it will be increased, the capacity will be increased to reach huge number of vaccines as by demand. Of course, we'll work closely with the Senegal by filling the gap in terms of access to vaccine for COVID-19 in our continent. So I think the quantity will be adjusted depending the need, but for itself, the capacity to produce whatever number is required is really there.
The World Health Organization reports that Africa currently imports more than 95% of its vaccines. BioNTech signed the same agreement with Senegal with partial funding by the European Investment Bank. Assiata Tall Sall, Senegal's Minister of Foreign Affairs, said the EU's investment in developing Africa's vaccination self-reliance shows what the African Union and the European Union can achieve together. This really means that when we work together, we can achieve a lot to determine the future of our people. If we don't work in synergy, we can only fail or don't achieve results of our caliber. In the signing ceremony, Jutta Urpilainen, EU Commissioner for International Partners, highlighted that the deal also could boost intra-Africa trade and hence alleviate poverty.
This day is about so much more than a piece of paper. It's about hope, innovation, and partnership. It's about our two continents joining forces to produce vaccines for Africa in Africa.
According to BioNTech, at the initial stage, its staff will own and operate the facility to support the safe and rapid initiation of the production of mRNA-based vaccine doses. The Africa Centers for Disease Control also has identified South Africa for a potential regional vaccine manufacturing hub. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Botswana has signed an agreement to host the Southern African Development Community's Standby Force Regional Logistics Depot, which will enable the region to rapidly deploy troops on peacekeeping missions. SADC countries recently sent more than 1,000 troops to help fight Islamic extremists in northern Mozambique, but the exercise faced mobilization challenges. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Bokandisi Dube has the details.
SADC and the Botswana government this week signed an agreement to pave the way for work to begin on the facility. SADC Executive Secretary Elias Makgosi said establishing the $45 million depot is key to promoting peace and stability in the region by providing a central platform for logistic support to the military force for peacekeeping missions. He said it would be used to store equipment, material, and end-user stock. Botswana's Minister of Defense, Justice and Security, Kagiso Mosie, who signed on behalf of the host government, said the depot will guarantee rapid deployment of troops. SADC was slow to deploy troops to Mozambique, with talks dragging as leaders struggled with logistics. Mosie says the recent deployment of soldiers in Mozambique has demonstrated the need for a logistics depot to mitigate against mobilization challenges. Adriano Nuvunga of the Maputo-based Center for Democracy and Development praised the creation of the facility.
This is a very important and timely move. Such logistical operation would enable SADC to intervene in future situations of crisis timely and adequately. If you look at the case of Mozambique, the SADC's response was very slow and inadequate.
Nuvunga says administration of the facility should be free from political interference.
It's governance. It is transparent. It is above the governance challenges affecting SADC member states at the moment. And that could also be a starting point towards a more stable regional force that could be used to stabilize where there are instances of instability. But that would also be the instrument of democracy and peace and stability within SADC region, which it is something that at the moment it is not firmly established.
The logistics depot was first mooted in 2004. The project has been accelerated as the region faces instability, particularly in Mozambique's Cabo Delgado and the Democratic Republic of Congo. The facility will be built in phases and is expected to be fully operational by 2026. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Habrone, Botswana.
Master of Jesus College, a British university in Cambridge, has agreed to hand over to Nigeria a sculpture that was looted by British troops in 1897. According to a Reuters report, the sculpture was one of hundreds of Benin bronzes that were pillaged from the once mighty kingdom of Benin, located in what is now Nigeria. They are among Africa's culturally significant artifacts. Nigerian authorities have been calling for their return for years. Nigeria's Minister of Information and Culture, Lai Mohammed, thanked Jesus College in Cambridge for being a trailblazer and expressed hope that other institutions who have African artifacts will do the same. Germany recently agreed to start returning Benin bronzes in its museums. In the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, militants suspected of being with the Allied Democratic Forces yesterday killed 12 people. This is the latest in a string of ADF attacks in Ituri province. Journalist Jafar Al-Katani in Goma has been covering the story and spoke earlier with my colleague Kate Bond-Dawson.
According to the president of Civil Society of Mamove, Ituri province, just near Beni, 12 bodies of people killed in the night of Tuesday, October 26th, in a village named Musenze, are floating in the water of Ituri River. ADF attacks in the night killed people and dropped bodies in the river.
Now, you have indicated there have been a number of attacks recently. What's going on?
Since Friday, there have been every day an attack in that region, an ADF attack. because, you know, ADF is operating in the south of Ituri and the north of North Kivu. So since Friday, there is an attack every day. Some of them are being contained by the FRDC and others have a very heavy result. On Monday, the army presented to the authorities and press a group of people arrested by the intelligence service at several border posts in the Beni region, and others were captured during the raid against the terrorists. Among those people, there is a wife of someone called Migo, recognized that as the second commander of ADF, and many people from other countries like Uganda, South Africa, and Burundi. So according to the army, this is how to certificate that ADF is not a Ugandan or a Congolese group, but an international terrorist group.
That was Jafar Al-Katanti in Goma speaking with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson. In Nigeria, it's been a year since the government's controversial Special Anti-Robbery Squad, or SARS, was disbanded. Large public protests led to the closure of the police unit, which was notorious for its human rights abuses. But observers say popular demand for holistic police reform has failed, and promises made by the president have not been implemented. From the Nigerian capital, Abuja, reporter Monachi Chuks talks with activists about the issue.
President Muhammadu Buhari responded to the NSAS protests with a speech 1 year ago promising a number of reforms. They include the ban on the Special Anti-Robbery Squad and promise to penalize erring officers. He also said the government would set up judicial panels of inquiry in all 36 states that will be chaired by retired high court judges and would include youths and members of civil society groups. To date, many but not all states have named their panels. Protesters had also called for the government to compensate families with members who had been tortured and killed by the police and have officers who had worked in the SARS unit to be psychologically evaluated before being reassigned to other work. They also called for an increase in pay for police in an effort to end corruption. But observers say expectations that the government would urgently initiate comprehensive reforms to end police misconduct have not been implemented. Frank Tete, a human rights and development lawyer in Abuja, expressed his disappointment.
1 year after, sadly, nothing has changed in the character and modus operandi of the National Police of Nigeria that is exclusively controlled by the federal government. The story of widespread human rights violation and general impunity have remained on the increase despite the NSAS protest of last year.
Tete labels the state's judicial inquiries set up by the government as make-believe.
The various NSAS panels of inquiry that were set up across the country to hear individual complaints of human rights violations by the Special Anti-Robbery Squad of the Nigerian Police were viewed largely by many Nigerians as a mere charade. This view is also shared by many policemen who believe that nothing will come out from the panels.
Civil rights activist Okechukwu Nwanguma urges Nigeria citizens to continue demanding for reforms to better the country.
Eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. If citizens remain vigilant and steadfast in demanding reforms, then reforms must happen. Civil society must continue to lead the charge in pushing for far-reaching reforms. The NSAS campaign was a mere spark for the more comprehensive police reform that is long overdue.
The international watchdog Human Rights Watch says hopes for accountability remain inconclusive and bleak. Nigerians want officials to tackle the systematic problems that foster a culture of impunity in the security sector and push forward with comprehensive and meaningful reforms to end the abuses and injustices Nigerians are still experiencing. The police spokesperson refused repeated requests to speak with the VOA. For VOA News, Munachi Chooks.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. Thank you again for tuning in.